Number one is House File 2128, Senate File 1760. Mr. Burritt.
Members, what this bill does, this last page under number one, under the attached number one is copy of the bill. And what the bill does is it would put employees of the Public Employees Retirement Association into a post-retirement employment provision. Again, this is employees of the Public Employees Retirement Association, and not all the individuals that are covered by that plan, but simply the members of the para staff. A copy of the entire section is a little bit earlier in the packet. It's a copy of 43A.346, post-retirement option. And basically what this entire section does is it would allow certain individuals who providing their employment at least half time to terminate service, retire, and then come back working less than half time, and also would have to be a reduction of at least 25% from their previous employment. This is at the appointing employee's discretion. It's not solely up to the employee. Basically, if there's a position available, and if the employer decides to offer to an individual, this treatment would occur. So the individual, if offered this option, could come back to work on a part-time basis. And for that period of time, any reduction in the annuity that might otherwise occur because the individual is reemployed would be waived. The issues are as noted in the memo or on the executive summary. The first one, we note there is a public purpose for any para staff. And the point we make in the memo here is that generally, what the state has been trying to do when it is offering these types of programs is to create budget savings. And adding para staff would not do anything to save the state any money because para staff is paid out of the assets of the retirement fund. Now, the same is true about MSRS staff. And if you look at the bill itself, you'll notice that MSRS staff is currently in the provision. The second issue is the purpose of any para staff, but not local government employees covered by para. Third is possible inclusion of TRA. TRA has indicated that they do not want to be included. And the fourth item is whether the commission wants to spend some time removing some ambiguity from section 43A.346. One area where the existing statute is ambiguous, if you look at subdivision 2, it's near the top of the page. Under clause 3, it indicates that individuals are eligible if they terminate service and at that point they meet the age and service requirements necessary to receive an unreduced retirement annuity. Unreduced retirement annuity is not anything that is defined in this section. And what I note is that sometimes an unreduced retirement annuity is thought of as an annuity that an individual takes at normal retirement age. That's the least controversial definition, clearly. But also, rule of 90 retirements are sometimes referred to as an unreduced retirement annuity. However, a rule of 90 retirement actually is reduced because a lower accrual rate is used to compute those annuities. So if the commission wishes to, it can decide whether to clarify that an unreduced annuity includes a rule of 90 benefit, that would be the 2A amendment, or if the commission felt it was appropriate to exclude a rule of 90 benefit,
That would be the 1A amendment. And the 4A amendment is an amendment dealing with the MSRS unclassified plan. Again, there's some language in the section itself that allows individuals in the unclassified plan to be in this program, again, with the employer's permission, providing they are drawing an unreduced annuity. Given that the unclassified plan is a defined contribution plan, I really don't know what is meant by an unreduced annuity, since any age that an individual seeks to retire under that plan would be an unreduced annuity, because there is just a defined contribution plan. It's not subsidized in any way. The individual receives the benefit that can be provided given the assets the individual has at that date. So with those comments, I turn it back to the chair.
Thank you. Ms. Vanek.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Mary Vanek, the director of PERA. We are asking that our staff be added to this provision because, for all intents and purposes, PERA staff are considered state employees. We are under the same collective bargaining agreements. We have the same benefit structure as all other state employees. This provides management at PERA and the board a very useful tool in managing the eventual retirement of individuals on our staff who are Rule of 90 eligible and still want to contribute and could be used as great mentors to the younger or less senior staff members who are still learning our business, but who also may not necessarily want to work full-time any longer. We don't see a lot of use of this, but we do see some areas where it could create some savings to us in our administrative budget. Although it's not a savings to the state general fund, it is a savings to us in terms of personnel costs. In keeping those very skilled and knowledgeable long-term staff members around on a part-time basis and helping us groom the next leaders of the organization. I did contact the Department of Employee Relations. They do support this. They think it's a useful tool for managing the baby boom transition in state government, which we are directly affected by. We need staff people around to help us transition out our members in the baby boom bulge, but we also have that bulge in our own population in the office of 90 people. So we appreciate your support of giving us the opportunity to use this as a management tool in better dealing with our personnel costs and resources.
Ms. Vanek, do you want to address the proposed amendment?
Madam Chair, the First Amendment would take out the people who are Rule of 90 eligible, so we don't support that amendment because it is those folks who would be the would most benefit from having this opportunity. The clarifying that the Rule of 90 is an unreduced benefit, that's a decision this body, I believe, has to make. We have always determined that Rule of 90 is an unreduced benefit. There's no early retirement reduction applied to people who retire under the Rule of 90 before normal retirement. And the other provision really affects Mr. Bergstrom's administration, so I really can't speak to 4A.
Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, I was going to ask about the unreduced retirement annuity. If we adopt the 2A amendment, it seems to me that may also affect MSRS. I don't know how they would feel about that amendment as well.
I bet they'd tell us. Mr. Bergstrom? That's the 2A one, right?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Mr. Bergstrom.
Chair, my name is Dave Bergstrom, the director of the State Retirement System. And my understanding is this just clarifies that the Rule of 90 is an unreduced annuity, and we would be fine with that amendment.
Madam Chair.
Senator Wergen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can someone tell me if someone comes back under this option, works a quarter time or whatever the case is, one of the reasons that we offer the rule of 90 is so that the high salaries are gone and we bring in people at a lower salary. I mean, it's a salary savings tool. We all know that. But when someone comes back and works again, what's the effect on the retirement when they retire the second time?
Ms. Vanek.
Madam Chair, Senator Wergen, this allows the individual to receive their retirement annuity and collect their salary for 50% full-time equivalent position without any reduction in their annuity. And this is limited to 5 years under the state's statutes. So we could allow somebody to come back on an annual basis and renew that provision for up to 5 years maximum. But there's no increase in the pension because they're not earning additional credited service. But they are allowed to collect their pension and not have it reduced because they are reemployed.
Mr. Bergstrom, do you have can you give us any anecdotal information about how this has been used since you've had this provision in your plan?
Madam Chair, 89 people have used it since it was passed about 2 years ago. It has worked very effectively, and Ms. Vanek is right. They, in essence, collect their retirement, no longer contribute into the retirement plan, but they get a portion of their health care paid. Really ties into workforce needs. In the state, in the next 10 years, about half the people who are currently state employees will be leaving. And I think some of that knowledge is going to have to be kept around. From our staff standpoint, we have no MSRS employees that have used it. So when I talk about 89, that's 89 state employees. We do have one person that I am discussing using it when that person retires because I'd love to keep his knowledge around. So.
Mr. Bergstrom, out of these 89 people, how many different employers were there? Or agencies, so to speak.
Madam Chair, I don't know the exact number, but it was spread through many of the state agencies. So I think it's a very effective tool.
It's not a whole lot. Right. Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, Mr. Bergstrom, do you have any thoughts on the 4A amendment? We talked about the 2A, but is there? I believe the 4A applies more to MSRS. Is that?
Mr. Bergstrom.
Madam Chair, what we have interpreted for unclassified members is full retirement is the equivalent of what we use for our general employees' retirement plan. So we're using Rule of 90 or age 65. And I'm not sure exactly what this amendment tries to do. Is that...
Members, the amendment would define for purposes of the MSRS unclassified plan, individual would have to be normal retirement age. So with this amendment, if an individual qualified under the rule of 90, they would no longer qualify. So if you want rule 90 to qualify, then presumably you would not want the 4A amendment. Just things ambiguous and gets interpreted the way it gets interpreted.
Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, I see no reason for the amendment then. We are administratively handling it to be consistent with our general employees' retirement plan.
Okay. Madam Chair, there's no questions or no one wants to be heard on this one. I'll move the 2A amendment.
Representative Betzel moves adoption of the 2128 2A amendment. Any further discussion? All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted.
And then, Madam Chair, I'll move that House File 2128, Senate File 1760, as amended, be incorporated in the omnibus pension bill.
Okay. Any further discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. 2128, as amended, is incorporated in the omnibus bill. Item 2, House File 1941, Representative Kahn.
Madam Chairman, this is from the minute. You want me to go up or can I stay here?
Either.
Okay, I'll stay here. This is from the Minneapolis Police Relief Association, and I have Larry Ward and Brian Rice are here to speak to it.
Mr. Ward, welcome. Mr. Rice, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Brian Rice, attorney for the Minneapolis Police Relief Association. This bill is brought to clarify some drafting errors that happened in 1997 and 2005, and if I could direct the committee's attention to the bill, page 1, line 14, excuse me, the printed bill I have is on page 1, line 14 and line 13, you'll see some stricken language. That language is obsolete. There was a phase-in in 2005. The legislature passed a law that increased the surviving spouse's unit by 1 unit, but they phased it in over a 2-year period, and so the bill simply strikes the 22.5 units per month until December 31, 2005, on both lines, page 1, line 14, and line 18 and part of 19. The significant part of the legislation, if I could track the committee's attention to page 1, line 15, the number 6 is stricken and the number 8 is included. What happened earlier this year when the state auditor was in the office of the Relief Association, he asked the executive director to explain how units were determined for surviving spouses. She went back to the statute and looked at the statute and found that in applying the literal terms of the statute, it did not match the practice that the Relief Association had. And what happened since 1992, all surviving spouses of Minneapolis Police Association whose husbands or spouses had been married or had worked for 20 years were entitled to 22 units. In 1990, there were 21 units based on a schedule and 1 unit for health and welfare. In 1997, the fund recodified or amended its laws and recodified a statute and combined the 1 unit for health and welfare and put it on the schedule that was 21 units. And this section of the statute provided 22 units for surviving spouses. And what happened at that time was when the 1 unit, health and welfare unit, was added in 97, the unit number was raised from 21 to 22, but the floor, starting at 6 units after 5 years, should have been raised from 6 to 7. Then in 2005, when we added this additional unit as part of refinancing legislation, an additional 1 unit, a 23rd unit, was added, phased in, a half a unit in 2005 and a half a unit to 23 in 2006. But that number 6, which should have been 7, should have been raised to 8. The fund has administered the plan this way. Currently, there are no surviving spouses of members with less than 20 years of service, but there are about 10 who've retired with less than 20 years of service. Their spouses potentially could be affected. We have not identified any spouse that would have been married to a member with 20 years of service or 21 years of service, but there could be. And the fund felt we just discovered it in February, late February this year when the auditor was in the office, and we're bringing the legislation forward to be corrected so there isn't an issue. We view it as an oversight. All the materials when we presented it to the legislature on our actuarial valuations in 2005 the actuarial valuations were based on giving a 23-unit pension to surviving spouses of 20-year members. So we view this as just corrective legislation, and we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Ward, anything to add?
No, that basically covers it. The oversight was on our part, and also it was not caught by the state auditor until last year. So when this was brought forward, we thought before it affects any of our members that the correction should be made.
Mr. Rice, Mr. Ward, Representative Kahn, do you have any thoughts about the proposed amendment, 1A, 2A? Representative Kahn.
Yeah, Madam Chairman, I guess I should let the more informed people respond, but it actually seems much better to make it retroactive than to give a deferred payment. But
Mr. Rice?
Madam Chair, I think what I'd say is that I think the way it's drafted, I think, is appropriate. I'd say we have not identified any members who, any surviving spouses who've had this. The potential does exist that there may be some. The issue that is, it's since 1992, all spouses were eligible for 22 units. If you make this not retroactive, there'd be a significant group who probably would be affected because the 97 legislation was, just inadvertent. There was no, in 97, no benefits were added. It was just how a statute was recodified. And so I don't think that Amendment 1A would be appropriate. And 2A, I think, is a local approval clause. The city has already, the city approved the legislation in 97 and 2005, so the policy question was really already addressed. This is really in the nature of just, last pension commission, you passed legislation to make corrections in the bill you passed last year. Those things came to the staff's attention sooner. I think this is just simply correcting a drafting error. And I don't think having local approval to correct the drafting error is something that's really necessary.
Representative Kahn.
Madam Chairman, I can't disagree with the commentary which says it's the fault of the people responsible for drafting, who did the drafting, and ignoring, I guess, the fault of the Pension Commission for ignoring the expression of concern by the commission staff. But the problem is those aren't the people who will pay for it. The people who will pay for it are people who obviously had no responsibility to do that. So I guess these guys are here saying that they're sorry. I'd not prefer that very innocent people pay for their mistakes.
Ms. Wagner.
Or our mistakes, if we wanted to say we ignored the commission memo.
City of Minneapolis is asked to respond.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Commissioners. My name is Betsy Hodges. I'm Chair of the Minneapolis City Council's Intergovernmental Relations Committee, and I'm here to testify on this bill. I appreciate the opportunity. And although the city does request that you add a local approval clause to this bill this morning so my council can know and understand the full issues here, the city is not going to oppose this legislation at this time. I understand the ramifications of failing to fix the statute. However, I do want to note that this is yet another example of the lack of accountability in the current structure for the MPRA. You have heard the association talk about its intent with respect to this legislation, and the only intent that should matter is the legislative intent that is indicated in the letter of the law, which is your law. For several years now, we as a city have been drawing attention to the willingness and the pattern of MPRA's willingness to push beyond the boundaries of the law for its own financial enrichment. As some of you may know, we are currently in litigation for a second time with this fund over the improper payment of benefits brought on by a system where those receiving the benefits hold majority positions in approving what those benefits are. The folks governing the benefits are the folks getting the benefits. In the city's eyes, the introduction of this bill is yet another example of MPRA's disregard for the law. This bill makes legal what MPRA has been doing illegally for some time now, and once again brings into light the practices of MPRA and its inability to balance its fiduciary responsibilities to taxpayers and members. The association again has put the legislature and the city in a very difficult position, which I understand. Either reward the association for its behavior or insist that the fund follow the law as is currently written and repay retroactively all the taxpayer dollars plus interest that it has paid out to survivors. The latter results in the survivors of our firefighters seeing, police officers seeing their benefit payments decrease, a benefit which they have grown accustomed to receiving for the past 8 years. We hope, while we are not opposing this legislation, we are asking for a local approval clause, and we are asking for your understanding and assistance as the city works to manage its obligation to our retirees.
Representative Kahn.
Well, Madam Chairman, I would speak, although not strongly, against the local approval clause. I mean, I think the mismanagement of the city of its pension policy is far greater than the mismanagement of the Police Relief Association. I carried a bill that had a local approval clause. One of the things, let me point out, the city is the only city in the country, if not the world, that bonds to cover pension payments. That's something that we allowed them to do, so I guess it's our fault, too. But no other city in the state has done that. I carried a bill which redid the police fund, which would have dramatically reduced the bonding. These years all start getting mixed up, so I don't remember what year it is, but I'm sure Mr. Rice's chronology is better than mine. We passed it in the legislature. The city had the prerequisite time to do the follow the local approval clause. They did not do the local approval clause, even though I think it would have reduced its need to bond by about $20 million. Again, I'm not, let me say, reduce the need to bond significantly. And the next year, they then came back and with essentially no change, a very minor change that we would have easily made in the legislation if they had said it at the time, then approved it. Because it was then, by then they realized the consequences of not doing it. I do think that if we are agreeing that this is a drafting error, we can talk about whose fault the drafting error is. I think the idea of local approval to correct the drafting error which for legislation which the city says it doesn't oppose is kind of ridiculous. But if we feel we need it, you know, I guess we'll put it on. I would just speak against it.
Measure.
Senator Betzel.
I think the local approval clause is appropriate. I don't know if it was a drafting error or not. Yeah. The legislature passed something. Apparently, the fund, whether they misread it or whatever, applied it a different way. But also, apparently, the city of Minneapolis approved it the way that it was passed by the legislature. If we're going to change the terms, however we want to characterize it, even if we say, well, it was a drafting error, I think that the city has a right to be able to approve, you know, whatever it is if we change it. Because if they were, you know, have the right to approve in the first instance, I don't think we can just change it and say, well, we didn't mean it, however it came about. So I think that the local approval clause is appropriate and even necessary here. So I'll move the 2A amendment.
Senator Betzel moves 1941 2A amendment. Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the city, did you, when you were approving this last time it came through, was there any discussion about whether it was 6 or 8, or did you understand, was that significant in your decision when you approved this policy the last time?
Ms. Hodges.
Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, I was not, I don't know the answer to that question.
And I know that was an unfair question to you, but anybody from the city that can address that? Nobody? Okay. Well, I would speak against the local approval clause in this circumstance.
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would concur with Representative Kahn and Representative Thiessen against the local approval clause in this circumstance as well, given the fact that it seems to me that there is a mistake that just wasn't caught here. This is, again, one something that I think we need to correct, and it's our responsibility to do that.
And Representative Kahn.
Let me emphasize again, the city has said that they don't approve it. I mean, what do they want the local... that they don't oppose it. What do they want the local... I mean, this isn't like it's a real complex issue. I mean, if they said that they didn't approve it or they had doubts or they had some changes or if it was 30 pages of legislation that they needed to go through, you know, I would be much more sympathetic to saying that they should have the local approval.
Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Having just come into this discussion, I'm actually yet unclear as to whether or not this is a drafting error or an oversight or was misinterpreted. And so I'm going to be, I will support the adoption of the local control provision.
Representative Smith.
Madam Chair, I guess I would just echo those who suggest a local approval clause is not necessary in this case.
Okay. Any further discussion? Any last words, Ms. Hodges?
Madam Chair, no, thank you for hearing this today. My intent as Chair of the Intergovernmental Relations Committee in requesting the local approval clause is knowing that historically we approved the legislation, that we would like the opportunity to review and fully understand the impact of this legislation. But again, we don't oppose it.
Senator Betzel renews his motion to adopt the 2A amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The motion does not prevail. Representative Kahn?
Is there any other amendment that's before us? Or?
No.
Okay. I guess I'd move that we pass, that we put 1941 as part of the omnibus pension bill.
Okay. Representative Kahn moves that House File 1941 be included, incorporated into the omnibus pension bill. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. Item 3, 2079, Senate File 1841, Mr. Fleming. This is a bill that we had before, and you're asking to make, instead of a pilot, to make it permanent, and it's an early retirement incentive, Mr. Fleming?
Yes, ma'am. Morgan Fleming, I'm here on behalf of Middle Management Association. So this covers all the public employees in Minnesota now. This is the product. Yeah, I think you have a strike after enacting clause. I mean, strike after a complete rewrite of the bill. And it's a amendment, and I defer to Larry Martin, I think 18A. And this incorporates the amendments. In your summary of the last meeting, April 23rd, there were 16 issues brought up, and Amendment 2A, 6A, 9A, 10A, 11A, 13A, and 14A are incorporated in this amendment. I think it's a it's an improvement for sure.
Members, if I can help you out, the 18A delete everything amendment is an attempt to resolve some of the issues that were raised in the commission staff memo that was presented or was available at the last commission meeting. What the 18A amendment does is basically, instead of making this incentive a permanent entity, which the original bill would do, it creates it for a period of 3 years until 2010. It also makes it generally applicable to all public employees in the state. The prior incentive that had been enacted in 2006 had some selective agencies or enterprises, but was not generally applicable. And it's not clear who the commission, who the legislature is trying to exclude from this incentive. So are the approaches changed to incorporate everyone, with the sole exception of elected officials, are not included in the incentive. It does also take out individuals who have already are retired and may have a second career in public employment, where someone has retired early from another pension plan, is now in public employment, is covered by a public pension plan. They're not entitled to the incentive since they've already are retired once. On page 2, this retains the use of this $17,000 incentive in that it can be used for one of three purposes, but it does specify that the deposits to the health care savings plan would be for those individuals who terminate during the early summer of each of the 3.5-4 years that it would be in place, and that the utilization of the $17,000 lump sum amount for either service credit purchases or the purchase of an annuity from the unclassified plan would be are restricted for individuals who do not are retired during that early summer period. The health care savings plan under federal tax law, as I understand it, is not to be an elective proposition. It's got to be a mandatory proposition. And so this makes it mandatory. Depending upon when somebody chooses to retire, they don't have the discretion to choose between the health care account or something else. They have to go into the health care account if they retire during that time window. On page 3, the new language towards the middle of the page requires the offer to actually be in writing. It was somewhat unclear in the 2006 version whether this could be in some form other than in writing with a written acceptance. And so this clarifies that there's got to be a paper trail in combination with this incentive. And then the bulk of the new language, new subdivision 4, requires a utilization report. One of the difficulties, as I understand it from the 2006 incentive, was that it was used relatively sparingly, and there's very little aggregated information on the utilization or whether there was any actual savings or any quantification of the savings. One item I did forget or omitted from pointing out to on page 2 in the middle, lines 217 through 220, does require that there be some oversight of granting the incentive for state employees. This would be the Commissioner of Finance, and for other entities, it's the presiding officer of the governing body if it's other than the state. My understanding is that Mr. Bergstrom from the state retirement system does have a couple of concerns relating to the health care savings account aspect of this and the utilization of the unclassified employees plan as the source for translating the $17,000 lump sum payment into a separate annuity. And Mr. Deans, on behalf of the school board, School Boards Association, also has concerns about the language on page 2, lines 17 through 20, when it comes to local government, whether the presiding officer of a governing body of a local government entity is the appropriate place to have the oversight. So those are the concerns that have been suggested to me since this draft has been circulating.
So,
Madam Chair, if I might.
Mr. Fleming?
Senator Polkemiller is not here this morning, and I visited with him, and on the last page of this amendment, page 3, there's this subdivision 4 utilization report, and this ties this amendment together. This provision now runs to 2010, a three-year period. And the reason is basically, and some would remember, this is the fiscal note of 1057 in 2005. And it ran for 3 years, and it had savings of $8 million over that period. But that was the omnibus bill, and there were just parts of this broke out about this window. So we'd like to, and it has a nice yearly reporting, we'd like to actually keep an eye on it to see if it has any utilization. So that's the theme and the connection on it, if I may.
Yes.
And Mr. Beans did mention the who is the counsel for the School Board Association, the problem on line 219. I guess he talked to Larry Martin about it, but would a mayor get to decide for a school board? But Mr. Deans is here if you'd like to talk to him.
Please, sit down.
Okay. Representative Murphy, members of the commission, the concern that I was raising
I'm
Tom Deans, I'm legal counsel of the School Board Association, is on page 2, line 19, where it says approval must be obtained from the presiding officer of the applicable governing board. We believe that it should say that approval should be obtained from the applicable governing board. It should be the school board, the city council, the county board that makes this decision, not the mayor or the chair of the school board that makes that decision.
Good suggestion. Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, is there an amendment that's drafted to that, or I'd like to offer that amendment if...
First of all, let us... I move the adoption of the Delete Everything 18A amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? And the amendment is adopted. Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, Mr. Deeds, if you could once again just restate that. There's an amendment that's been drafted to that effect.
No. Members, there is not an amendment, but if I understand Mr. Deeds' comment correctly, if on page 2, line 19 of the 18A amendment, if you delete presiding officer of the, you will get what he's suggesting.
Madam Chair, I would move adoption of an oral amendment to delete the first four words on lines 2.19.
Senator Lynch moves the deletion of presiding officer of the and insert.
No, nothing.
No insertion.
Just delete it.
Delete from the. Okay. All in favor of the Lynch motion, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted. Mr. Stoffel.
Okay. Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Jay Stoffel, Director of Duluth Teachers Retirement Fund. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. I just want to point out, it appears to me a little bit of confusion. On page 1 of the Delete All Amendment, we are included as one of the employers eligible for the incentive, since we're listed on line 21 as a fund in section 356.30. But then on page 2 of the bill, the use of the incentive on lines 8 through 12 is to go towards the purchase of the Rule 90 benefit, and it lists the authorizing statutes for MSRS, PERA, and TRA, but it excludes the first-class city teacher funds. So if you wanted to correct that, I would suggest at line 12, after the second paragraph B, just before the word whichever, I would insert 354A.31, subdivision 6, paragraph B.
Please. Do it one more time and a little bit slower.
On line 12 of page 2, after the second paragraph B, insert 354A.31, Subdivision 6, Paragraph B.
Is that get St. Paul too?
That would include then Duluth and St. Paul teachers' retirement funds. And then that also needs to happen, that same insertion needs to occur on line 25 of page 2 after the small b in parentheses.
And do you think we should do that, Mr. Stoffel?
Well, my board does not really have a position on it. It's we wouldn't oppose it, but we really haven't taken a position either way on it, just pointing out the inconsistency.
Madam Chair, if I may.
Mr. Fleming?
I defer to Larry Martin, but it's an oversight without intent. It's, oops, a mistake on my part.
They didn't merge all the funds.
Mr. Bergstrom.
Madam Chair, my name is Dave Bergstrom, and I'm the director of the Minnesota State Retirement System. I'm not here to speak against the policy, but I do have two technical issues that I would like to raise. First is that to maintain the tax advantage of the health care savings plan, it cannot allow individual choice. It has to be something that is mandated by an employer. The windows that they have set up in on page 2, lines 1 through 5, I think the IRS, and I can't say for sure because nobody knows necessarily what the IRS, but they may interpret that as employees having choice because they could time their retirement to qualify for this money going into the health care savings plan. An alternative to that would be to have the employer decide whether to offer the health care savings plan or the retirement increase. That would take it out of an individual choice. So that's the one concern that I have. The second concern that I have deals with line 2.13 to 2.16, and that allows, according to my reading of this, employees from who are teachers or city county employees to purchase an annuity through the unclassified plan. And it would, in essence, make us kind of a buying an insurance. We'd be in the business of selling annuities to people not in our program, and we'd also be administering real small payments to a group of employees who would decide to purchase service. As a solution to that, I think that the employees could buy that same service in each of the appropriate pension plans. So teachers could buy service from TRA, city, county, non-teaching school employees could buy service from PERA, and state employees could buy from MSRS. That way we don't have little payments that we're administering, plus taking the mortality gain and loss in the unclassified plan annuity.
Mr.
Madam
Fleming.
Chair, if I might. Thank goodness these people attend the meetings, because I talked to David Bergstrom about this, and another oversight on my part. And as far as the first comment about the IRS being gimlet-eyed or kind of aggressive on constructive receipt, or do you have the money if you make the decision, have anything, then you pay taxes on it. I sure defer, and it sure is nice to be safe instead of sorry on that matter. To make sure that those monies go in tax exempt and health care savings plan. Good amendment.
Members, Mr. Bergstrom did visit with me about these two concerns, and I did draft some language. The 19A document that's being handed out right now relates to Mr. Bergstrom's first concern having to do with the constructive receipt potential problem. And this refashions the provision so it's no longer dependent upon the timing of somebody's retirement, but specifies that the health care savings account would be the option if that is what the employer decides for the initial use of the incentive. And if the employing unit doesn't decide to use the health care incentive as the initial, during the initial granting of one of these incentives, then the other two options apply.
Mr. Bergstrom, does this meet with your approval?
Madam Chair, it does.
And it addressed both the things that you said.
Madam Chair, this addresses his one. First issue. I do have language for the second issue, but I decided not to confuse with having two documents.
This makes the choice that the employer should offer.
Madam Chair, that is correct.
I'll move the A-19 amendment then.
Senator Betzel moves the A-19 amendment.
Can I make one comment before you vote?
Yes.
Members, before you vote, just so there's some clarity, this does tie everything to the initial grant of the incentive, which can occur now in 2007 and would run for the entire 3.5-year course of it. So if the Department of XYZ grant uses the health care savings account, that sets the parameters for that department for every subsequent incentive for the full run of this program until 2010. So just so you understand, this is once you use it the initial time, whatever way you use it, that's the way that's going to be used in that particular entity forever for the 3 years that this runs, 3.5 years that it runs. So there's no flexibility. Once a choice is made, because the constructive receipt document doesn't allow flexibility, you have to set it in some fashion. When it's a one-year-only program and you set it based on time, that does it. This is what Mr. Bergstrom was suggesting. I just want to make sure that when you do this and someone comes back in 28 or 2009 saying, gee whiz, I wanted to use it X and I can only use it Y, and that's a problem, that you've been aware of it at the start of it rather than hearing about it after.
Mr. Fleming, you understand that and accept that?
Madam Chair, it's a delightful thing, outcome.
Any further discussion? If not, all in favor of 19A amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Any further discussion on the 18A amendment?
Madam Chair, I guess the other issue Mr. Bergstrom is being handed out now, but maybe we should just back up and take care of that issue for a second.
Okay.
And I'll move the language that was suggested for on page 2, lines 12 and 25, to insert 354A.31 subdivision 6, paragraph B. That would take care of Duluth teachers and St. Paul teachers, as apparently that was an oversight.
Is there someone from St. Paul teachers here? Mr. Koppel, do you want to be included?
Madam Chair, members, St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund Board doesn't have a position on this particular piece of legislation. I think if you're going to be including Duluth, and it's a pretty broad and sweeping bill, I don't know that our board would have any strong opposition to it, so we're not opposed, not seeking it.
Madam Chair.
Just a minute. One more wants to get in on this. Education Minnesota.
Yes, Renee Laro with Education Minnesota. Our position is that this option may very well work out in the future if the flaws are fixed, and we would want all the state's educators to be, or teachers to be part of it. So we would support Senator Betzold's proposed amendment to include Duluth and St. Paul.
And Senator Betzel, that's the 354A.31 subdivision 6 paragraph B,
yes,
part in those two on line 212 and line 225.
That's
right?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Okay. All in favor of the Betzel motion, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted. And then we have Amendment 20A, which addresses the other part of Mr. Bergstrom's suggestions.
Yes. Madam Chair, the 20A amendment remodels the provision on page 2 that currently provides that all of the utilization of the incentive payments to purchase an annuity from the unclassified plan, it changes that to be purchasing an annuity from the particular retirement plan that the person is a member of, by using the same factors that are used for basically the transfer to the post fund or the computation of optional annuity factors, that factor be used in converting this dollar amount into a monthly annuity amount. This gets the unclassified plan out of the business of being an insurer or a mini insurance company and having a different potential risk pool than they would normally undertake. This leaves everyone in their current risk pool, which presumably does less damage to the actuarial underfooting of the various pension plans.
Madam Chair.
Senator Wergen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's very technical, but if we do it exactly the way the amendment reads, won't we then have a double the on line 15, number of years from the applicable?
Mr. Martin.
The senator would be correct. On for I document 20A, on line 1.3, the initial the at the end of the line would not be necessary.
Madam Chair, I'll move that amendment to the proposed amendment.
Senator Wergen moves the deletion of the word the on line 1.3. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Thank you.
Very good.
Mr. Bergstrom, any other comments on 20A?
Madam Chair, just so I understand, the amendment then would allow each of the retirement plans to calculate what that amount would be using the required reserves under 356.551. And so as long as that's good, Madam Chair, I think it's a good amendment. I'd also like to thank Mr. Martin for his help in drafting both of these.
That's my understanding, Mr. Bergstrom. Any further discussion? Did somebody move?
I'll move the 20A amendment as amended.
Senator Betzel moves an adoption of 20A amendment as amended. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion is adopted.
Madam Chair.
Representative Thiessen.
Just on that A, on the 19A, I'm sure the staff would correct this anyway, but did we get that appointing already? Okay.
On line 9.
I think it's just saying.
Yes. Representative Thiessen moves. To put appointing. Technical amendment, put appointing on line 1.9 instead of just appoint. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion is adopted. Representative Kahn.
Well, Madam Chairman, I have a little problems with the basic theme of this bill, is that I really think we have to look very carefully at early retirement incentives as we're looking at demographic trends. And Senator Betzel knows that we've put a couple of things in the now vetoed, but I assume at some point to be resurrected, state government finance bill on studying these kinds of things. But looking at, I mean, apparently, just looking at population trends and people's lifeline trends, we're really going to need people to keep working, and we're not going to want to encourage early retirements, you know, except in very specific cases. I think we want to do as we did in the earliest bill, the idea of more flexible work periods is a very positive thing for both new employees and to keep on older employees. But I really would like us, I don't know what exactly the date should be, maybe the date written in the 19 Amendment, but I'd be very cautious about making this permanent. And I think looking over the possible amendments, I don't know how many we need to adopt or we would, but I'd like to, I'd like us to keep some sunset date, whatever number people want. I think 2008 is a reasonable sunset date. I'd like the 2A amendment, the require, and I don't know if we have to do this, if we have to do these by amendments. Oh.
This one expired in 2010.
Oh.
I don't know if
that. I don't know if I like 2010 or not. We can have some discussion. 2008. If we're willing to look at this over the interim, I'd rather have a 2008. I'm kind of looking at the amendments on the potential amendments on the initial memo. So I think I'd prefer 2008 to 2010, but I certainly prefer to have a date rather than no date. And I certainly like 2A requiring the data collection on early retirement incentive utilization. I don't know if we have to do that by law. I don't know if we can just kind of do that. It's in that? Okay.
That's in the
deletion. I'm sorry. The problem of reading the previous amendment and then not looking at the existing one. So, but that, anyway, that's my thought.
Well, Senator Betzel.
If I understood Mr. Fleming's testimony, the A18 amendment incorporates some of the amendments.
Yes.
Which, and maybe we could...
Would you go through and say which ones?
Somebody, which ones were they?
Mr. Martin.
Thanks.
Or Mr. Fleming, read all this.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Fleming.
The amendment strikes the word early because it doesn't... the normal retirement ages of 65 and 69 post-89 stay. The rule of 90 stays like it is for people 89 and before hires. And the 55 corrections for public safety stay the same. So the normal retirement ages stay the same. So that's why we took the word early out. The reason it runs to 2010, frankly, that in this enactment last year, the healthcare savings plan doer told me that there were less than 10 people that took advantage of it in that little window. So frankly, that the bargain units have to pay attention to it. And if it has some value, is to be an advocate for it and work with whoever the commissioner is in that employing unit to see if this is a tool to be used. Representative Kahn is absolutely right. Middle management has 2,700 members. The average age is over 50 years old. This fiscal note says of the state employees that in 05 that 8,000 were eligible for retirement. So it's you certainly are right, this thing about what's going to happen to the good in government service, the employees, when they retire, when they leave. That sure is a big problem. Anything that makes that a policy discussion or consideration on an ongoing basis, I know that we as a bargain unit and all the rest would love to be involved in that.
Madam Chair.
Representative Kahn.
Well, to talk, you know, the initial window was June 2nd to September 1st. That is really a very short window. But a window that goes into 2008 is considerably longer. I don't feel strongly about whether it's 2008 or 2010. I just feel very strongly about not making it permanent. So just any other members who...
18A makes it 2010 and non-permanent, so...
Members, the question was what amendments from the original bill document were included in 18A, and I'm prepared to go through that now. 1A, with the exception it's not 2008 but 2010, is included in 18A. 2A was included in 18A. 4A was included in 18A. 6A was included in 18A. 8A was included in 18A, 10A was included in 18A, 11A was included in 18A, 13A was included in 18A, 14A was included, and 16A was included.
Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, I do have one other question, and I don't know if Mr. Fleming has talked to Dewar or if Dewar is here. I remember a few years ago when we first were going into this, Commissioner Ludeman, who was then ahead of Dewar, had some concerns about early retirement in general, and I think may have paralleled what Representative Conner just talked about. I think for different reasons, though, but he did not like the idea of paying people to leave early, even though at the time there was going to be some cost savings and there were some reasons why we did it, and ultimately we resolved that. I trust that Dewar does not have any concerns about what this is going to do, but I don't know if they're here or if anybody's talked to them.
They haven't contacted me. Mr. Fleming?
Senator Betzel is an author of the bill on the reorganization of Dewar, and we have the authors are nice enough to add a two-year provision about protecting employment. And so I haven't talked to Commissioner Pat Anderson or Jared this week. Jared had seen this last week, and I talked to him as I was talking to Larry. So I don't know their position. I got the number of less than 10 in the health care savings plan from the window in the NAC last year from the agency. So I don't know.
Well, Madam Chair, I don't think Commissioner Ludeman is concerned about his own particular agency. I think he was concerned about the overall policy. And that, I recall that from a few years ago when we were first adopting this, and ultimately we were able to get, and I think maybe the short period of time, the sunset, was able to do it. But I do remember there was some opposition to the idea of having early retirement incentives with an aging workforce. And it wasn't just Dewar specific. It was, you know, across government.
Senator Bergen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not at all sure that I like this bill, but part of it might be a little bit of a lack of understanding. One of the things that I want to know, and maybe there's no connection at all, but how does this retirement incentive tie back into the post-retirement employment bill that we had a little bit earlier? Are we paying people to retire early to bring them back on staff at a lesser amount of time, in other words, on a part-time basis? How does this tie into that?
Mr. Fleming.
The original idea on the legislation was is that if someone leaves state service, that they do have 6 months unemployment, 6 months health insurance paid to them. That is north of $17,000. That's paid, there's no question. So the thought would be is that a younger person could stay, and someone close to retirement could go, and that wage differential is great. That's where the savings come from. The idea, and Mr. Martin and I visited quite a bit about what would keep someone's exceptions where someone would come back and have an unfair advantage about getting a benefit and then coming back to work the following week. Then you get into the thing about posting jobs and can't fill them. What do you do about a temporary thing come back? So the thing about the commission, the amendment that says the Commissioner of Finance has to sign off on all of these matters, particularly the Dewar reorganization, seems to police any kind of things that would bring misapprehension to this.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. I think, or Madam Chair, I think there really are some policy considerations here, and that there is potentially an interplay based on whether we're going to be looking at workforce shortages, and I would really be comfortable making it. I don't know how long it's going to take to study this issue, if it can be done over the interim, but perhaps if we had a shorter sunset date, that would be an incentive to focus on this issue and look at those broader policy considerations sooner rather than later.
Senator Wergen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure. I didn't distinctly hear an answer to my question about the tie-in between this and the rehire after retirement.
Bergstrom.
Madam Chair, my name is Dave Bergstrom, the Director of the State Retirement System. And again, my board doesn't support or oppose this, but maybe to help answer Senator Wergen's question. under Subdivision 3, the only way an employer can be offering this incentive would be if they are experiencing layoffs or reorganizing or downsizing. One possible solution would be that if someone receives an incentive under this, they could not take advantage of the other one. I mean, if you really wanted to clarify that. But I think they serve two different purposes. One is intended to encourage people to leave during the time of layoff or reorganization. The other one is more of a workforce plan to keep people on board. I clearly understand the concern. You don't want them to get both. And I think you could probably draft some language that does that.
Well, Madam Chair,
Senator Wergen,
follow-up. That's my exact concern. We're going to incent the retirement by giving a payoff, and then we're going to hire back the same high-wage employees that we're incenting to retire. To me, this is like we're trying to stick our tongue in both cheeks at the same time, and it isn't working. Unless there would be that amendment, I'm not so sure that I would support the bill.
Madam Chair. 12A?
Yeah.
Look at Amendment 12A.
That is the one that I wanted to.
Please.
Madam Chair, if I could.
Mr. Martin.
If you go to the original document, the staff materials for the original bill, 12A, which is drawn not to the 18A amendment, but to the bill as drafted, but does supply a new subdivision, does provide that anyone who receives the incentive is not to be reemployed or retained for some period of years to be specified after the receipt of the incentive, which presumably would address most, if not all, of the concern about the revolving door issue.
On this point, Representative Nelson?
I guess...
Go ahead.
To the point I'm hearing, and maybe I'm not hearing it correctly, but this subdivision 3, this applies in times of when we have a budget shortfall or we're trying to downsize a department, that offering these incentives to people that are close to retirement, I guess the benefit would be you'd keep other employees on that might get laid off, that if this person is going to retire in a year anyway, we keep this, these other people, delay somebody off, and then they're not going to be there when the other person and their knowledge will be gone, plus the knowledge of the older employee will be gone. This is a way of keeping people that are going to be here a while so we have some institutional memory or have some knowledge base to work on, so that a year from now or 2 years from now, when the person that we're incenting now to retire goes, we don't have to hire somebody brand new and start from scratch. And so we lose both the short-term and then we also lose the long-term knowledge. I guess that's what I am looking at, and maybe I'm wrong.
I guess that's Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two things. One, I would just like staff to confirm one of the concerns that I had in reviewing the materials was that there was an apparent discrepancy between the Minsky faculty as related to this. And if I'm reading this correctly, I think that concern has been addressed in the 18A, and I just want confirmation of that.
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator, the differential in the 2006 window, the incentive was 15-year eligibility requirement for some Minsky employees and a 5-year eligibility requirement for other Minsky employees. This sets it at 15 for all Minsky employees.
Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, thank you. And my other comment is that we have had some good discussion on this today. I'm a bit surprised at the number and the degree of the sometimes technical and sometimes very substantive concerns and changes that have been discussed here today. And I would just offer that I'm feeling like this needs much more work, and I'm uncomfortable with the amount and the nature of some of the discussion here on something that is has potentially such a significant impact.
Madam Chairman.
Representative Kahn.
Well, I'd like to do two things. The first thing is, and I think it's echoing what Senator Lynch has said, I'd like to put the 2008 amendment in, so that gives us plenty of time to look at it. You know, I'm not quite as concerned as you are, because we did have this memo well in it. Once it was clear to me how much of the memo, you know, when I thought was incorporated in the 18A amendment, I was much more comfortable with, you know, with the fact that we didn't have to deal with those one at a time. And then the next amendment I'm going to move, I hope we'll take the 2008, because I think that gives us the real incentive to look at it. And I think, and I don't know if we want to change that number about when the data is collected. Someone might want to, when we change it to 2008, there's data that's coming in August 1st, 2008. We might want to change. I'm not sure how much.
January.
And then the next amendment I want to move is the 12A, but someone has to fill in what that period of years is. I randomly want to say, you know, 5 years or something like that, because I think that that's enough to.
Representative Thiessen.
Well, Madam Chair, I guess I should clarify what amendment we're on.
Well, let's do the one for 2008. I just wanted to put in that I also wanted to do the other one.
Representative Kahn moves on page 3, line 3.28, to change July 15th, 2010 to 2008.
Then somewhere there's a report there on August 1st.
That's on line 312.
So you want to make that January 1st? January 15th, I think we always decided, is a more humane day to receive reports.
January 15th, 2008.
That means we must.
It has to. We have to get the report before we expire.
The report is in the utilization of the program.
Yeah. Maybe 2009 is a better date for the expiration.
Yeah. Okay.
Because we want to look at it. It gives us.
Okay. Khan moves online.
Members, if I could suggest also, if you're consistent with the Khan motion, on page 1, line 15, there's a 2010 date that's referenced, and that should be changed also, I believe. And then on page 3, line 12, there's a reference to annually thereafter, which would no longer be necessary if this is going to be for only 1 year. Or essentially 1 year.
I include all those in my amendment.
Madam Chair.
Senator Wergen.
Madam Chair, just the fact that we're having to tinker and change and do and redo, is there an urgency for this bill?
Yeah.
Deadline. There's a sunset on the program right now.
Madam Chair, what's the harm in letting it sunset?
Well,
there's a few people that are planning on using it this spring or this summer.
Madam Chair, to that point.
Representative Thiessen.
I mean, we've talked a lot about state government employees in this discussion. I think that actually the more valuable use of this is, at least for my school district, the city of Minneapolis. It would also apply there, and I think this would be a very valuable tool, and with a lot of different considerations than we've been talking about with regard to state employees there. And so I would like to see this move forward. If you want to take state government out, I'm fine, but I'd like to at least keep the school districts in there.
Madam Chair, if I may, last year the amendment was offered by teachers at the request of Local 59 Minneapolis School District and Rose Hermanson, Louise Sundin, and
Sir. Ms. Hermanson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Rose Hermanson with the Minneapolis Teachers. I'd like to thank the comments by Senator Representative Thiessen. Minneapolis had about 4,700 teachers in 2000. We are now down to approximately 2,800. We've lost about 40% of our teaching force. And we are losing all of our young teachers. Most of our probationary teachers are gone, and a lot of this is due to declining enrollment. So we really do think it's very important that we do something now so the district can plan, teachers can plan, and we can keep some of those younger teachers. I'd also like to make a brief comment on the 12A amendment. Many times, and not just specifically for Minneapolis, we take retired teachers, especially in outstate, they use them as subs. So I think I'd be a little careful as we draft that amendment to make sure that a school district still can use those teachers as subs, especially in the areas of special ed. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members.
Just gets bigger and bigger.
Yeah. Madam Chairman.
Representative Kahn.
Well, first we're working on the sunset date, and then I'd like to speak to the 12A.
Representative Kahn is moving the adoption of substituting 2008 July 15th date.
No, we decided 2009 seemed to make more sense for how we do it.
2009.
Well,
for the report. For the report.
Oh, okay. Yes, I'm sorry. Okay. Fix the report. Yeah.
For the report, the utilization report, to have a deadline of July or January 15th, 2009. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Okay. Then Representative Kahn is suggesting the July 15th date of expiration on line 3.28 and line 1.15.
Madam Chairman, would it be possible to still get that report in 2008? Because I think we really want to keep the report in 2008, January 15th, 2008, but change the expiration to, we want more time between the report and the expiration. So the utilization report would be January 15th, 2008. On line 312, and then the retirement, and then the expiration date would be July 15th, 2009. Yes. So that we have, because I don't like the idea that we just have a legislative, you know, we know the problems of the Pension Commission meeting during the legislative session, and I'd like to make sure that we have a little more time. So it's kind of a compromise.
Okay, so the utilization report, January 15th, 2008.
Yeah.
The expiration of the...
Oh.
You want to go back to August 1st, 2008. No, I don't think we're going to get information by January of 2008. So I think we want to just keep line 3.12 the same, except take out and annually thereafter.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
That's fine.
That's fine.
Please restate it, Representative Thiessen, the whole amendment.
Yeah.
I think we're changing the 2010s to 2009 on page 1 and page 3.
Yeah, that's the only change.
And then, well, and I think on 3.12 we want to take out the words "and annually thereafter."
Well, Madam Chair.
Representative, or Senator Wergen.
Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, I don't think you want to take out the "and annually," because there would be a second report before it sunsetted. So I think if you just leave that in, you take care of it. If you simply change to July 15, 2009 on 3.28 and 1.15, you accomplish what you're looking for.
All right.
Thank you, Senator.
Madam Chair, having voted on the prevailing side, I move that we reconsider the vote on page 3, line 12, where we change August 1, 2008 to January 15, 2008. We've already adopted that. I think we have to reconsider it.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is reconsidered.
Okay.
Representative Thiessen.
I think we're done, aren't we?
No, we have to vote on that.
All right, then I move that. We're changing 2010 to 2009 in those two places.
No, we have to vote on the reconsideration.
All right.
Madam Chair.
We didn't vote on that part.
Madam Chair, we voted on reconsideration, but the motion then needs to be laid to withdraw.
But you're including that.
I'm including that.
Oh, okay.
Madam, so the 2009 and then the July 2008 for the report.
Just leave it alone.
Right.
Madam Chair, my motion would just be solely to change 2010 to 2009 on those two, on line 1.15 and 3.28.
Madam Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Do we also have to change the 2010 on line 2.14 to 2009?
Madam Chair, members, we got rid of those time specifications in one of the two amendments that Mr. Bergstrom suggested.
Okay.
So those have been removed from this draft by a prior amendment.
Okay. The Thiessen amendment is before us. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted.
Now, Madam Chairman, I'd like to deal with the 12A amendment. I'd like to have somebody suggest the period of blank years, and I'd like to have some language that makes sure that teachers can be hired as substitutes.
Well, Madam Chair,
as
the substitute teachers, I don't know that a substitute teacher is considered as a consultant.
Okay.
I just don't see.
I just want to be sure that you could hire substitute teachers under this. I would think, with the question.
Yeah.
You can't
but
hire
permitted
teachers
to employ
that are out on retirement as substitutes. That's what the intent
yes.
is, and you do not want to not for the school district not to be able to hire those people. Teachers should be, if they want to be a substitute, they can be a substitute, and this language does not prohibit that.
Well, it's permitted to employ is
yes.
the
yeah.
issue.
Madam
except
Chair.
Maybe just accept as a substitute teacher.
Yeah.
But
okay. I would Senator Olson.
I would agree, Madam Chair, that even though they're not a consultant, because it says permitted to employ, that we need to accept them specifically if we want them
to be able. I think
Thiessen
has them.
Madam.
Representative Thiessen.
Madam Chair, I had jotted something down after we had Ms. Hermanson's testimony, but that another sentence that just says this provision does not prohibit a school district from employing as a substitute teacher an individual who received an early retirement incentive under this section.
And how many years do you want in there?
I have no idea.
Madam Chair, I'll suggest three.
I would
okay.
Okay.
Three.
That's what I would have said, too.
All right.
But I said
the Thiessen amendment is on 12A, line 1.4. 5, 3 years, and then add.
This provision does not prohibit a school district from employing as a substitute teacher an individual who received an early retirement incentive under this section. I have it.
Any further discussion? Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to ask the commission to think about this for just a second. 3 years, $17,000. I don't know.
What?
It seems a little. I understand the concern that Senator Wergen and I echo your concern, but I also think that there's a practicality to this, and that there are an awful lot of individuals who. A lot of agencies and organizations benefit by having them come back in a part-time or consultant sort of a role. And so I would just suggest that, at least in my mind, 3 years seems a little steep.
Madam Chair, if I might.
Mr. Fleming.
First of all, thank you for the inordinate amount of time on this issue this morning. And when Larry Martin and I visited about 12A a lot, we thought of instances that came to our mind, and an unnamed fellow an analyst in the Senate after 28 years, retired three, 4 years ago. But they could call him and he would come and tell them things. So the institutional memory was available. So what Representative Nelson was talking about is a real matter. So I don't know what the comity or the solution to this is, but it's an issue that
the solution is that we're going to have to be looking at this within 3 years because we have the new deadline on it. And so when we're talking about this and in the whole concept of retirement benefits, that we will keep this in mind and we will discuss it at that time. Because I think it's valid points. Everything that's been made here is valid points today. But we're having this window for such a short time more before we make a final decision in the interim that I think 3 years today is fine, and the added sentence for the teachers is okay in the Thiessen Amendment. So all in favor of adoption of the 12A amendment with the 3 years and the Thiessen add-on language, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion
no.
is adopted. Any further discussion?
Madam Chair, I'll move that the 18A amendment as amended be in we've adopted that, so actually it's to the new House File 2079 as amended be incorporated into the omnibus pensions bill.
All in favor of the Betzfeld motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted.
Thank you, ma'am.
Pardon? Yeah. Number five, Representative Thiessen, have you come up with any amendments and $6 million or whatever for the St. Paul teachers in 4 minutes?
I haven't come up with $6 million.
What about number four?
The Minneapolis Fire.
Yeah, can we do four?
Oh, the Minneapolis Fire. I'm sorry, yes. That's next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I would move House File 2453 that it... be incorporated in the omnibus pension bill, and I think we have some witnesses to testify.
Madam Chair,
good
Commission
morning,
members.
Mr. Shermer.
My name is
Welcome.
Walter. Thank you. My name is Walter Shermer, and I am the Executive Secretary of the Minneapolis Firefighters Relief Association. Our purpose in being in front of you today is to try and explain where this situation came from. Once the board realized that there was excess investment income this year based on a five-year average of salary increases and investment returns, I hadn't done it in such a long time that I thought I'd better look at the state law and see how it reads, make sure I did it correctly. When I was doing that, I noticed that the law allows us 1% of the fund's total assets, but that 1% then is reduced by one half by an amount that's to be left to make up for state amortization aid. Since we don't receive state amortization aid any longer, I felt that maybe the 1% then should be applied for the members, for distribution to the members. And so we took that issue and drafted this legislation to put before you to see if indeed that's what the commission might feel also. I noticed in Mr. Martin's summary of this issue that it states that we're doubling our benefit. In actuality, I don't see how that was determined. And if the chairman and commission members would permit, I would like to ask Brian Rice, our counsel, if he would address that situation and see if we can determine where Mr. Martin was coming up with the doubling of our benefit. Our benefit under this particular section of the law is limited to a previous year's monthly benefit. Currently, this won't apply to this year because this year we'll be giving about 70% of one of last year's pension benefits. But what we're trying to get at is possibly being able to give a full benefit or a full check from last year's payments. I also don't know where this 13th check terminology comes from. It's I've always referred to it as post-retirement benefit. I think the 13th check is a nickname that was attached to this legislation years ago because it was limited to a previous year's monthly benefit. But I've been trying to squelch that terminology for years, and I even have trouble doing that amongst my own members. But I guess it's because it's easy and it's a catchy phrase. But I always refer to this as a post-retirement adjustment, and it's based on our performance. If we have good performance, we can distribute the benefit. If we don't, we can't. We haven't done it for like 5 years. So that being said, I would like, if the chairman permits, to allow Brian Rice and Mr. Martin to address the doubling issue that was raised in the summary.
Mr. Rice.
Madam Chair, Brian Rice, Minneapolis Fire Relief Association General Counsel. I'll go through three. I think it's been handed out, three documents, and I'll try to make this quick. On the blue one, it shows that under current law, because of this provisional law, the firefighters will pay out a benefit of $2,581 to the 42-unit service pensioner, $1,300 to surviving spouse. They haven't paid it for 5 years. Had this the provisions of House File 2453 been in effect, the benefit would have gone up about $900 for retirees and $473 for surviving spouses. That's because if you look at the bill, 2453 on page 2, line 14 to 16, the percent of assets are one measure, but there is a limitation that you can't pay more than 1 month's benefit. So currently, current law would allow the fund to pay about 70% of 1 month's benefit. The legislation does not double a benefit. It does increase it. If you look on the white page, here are the calculations for this year. It's the third sheet in your packet. The assets of the fund at the end of the year were $263 million, almost $264 million. 0.5% of the assets would be $1.3 million. The average monthly benefits paid was $1,759,000. If this law were in effect for 206, which it's not, nor would it apply retroactively, we're not suggesting that, but just for illustration, if it had been in effect, this would have been there would have been an additional payout of $440,000, and that amounts to about 0.6% of the assets of the fund. I think the issue, as Mr. Shermer said, when the legislation has currently the current law has language that for the Fire Relief Association no longer applies because when it became 100% funded, when the stock market was very high in the late 90s, early 2000, the state aids that were coming into the fund, general fund amortization aid, stopped. Under the prior law, the theory was 0.5% of the excess investment income went to members in the form of a benefit, 0.5% went to the benefit of the state, and it acted as a credit against future state aid payments. The state is no longer supporting this fund because there's another provision of law that ended those amortization aids when it reached 100% funding. The last sheet to give the committee a better picture is the green one. These are years. There isn't any magic about these years. It's just that I was in my office over the weekend, and these were the years that I could get my hands on quickly. This shows the benefits as a the monthly benefit paid as a percent of total assets. In 1989, when this legislation was enacted, the benefits were about 0.7% paid each month to assets. The funding ratio was 57%. In the late 90s, early 2000, the monthly benefits were about a little less than 0.5%, 0.45% of monthly benefits to assets. The funding ratio was 189,907. And then the most recent year, if this legislation were in effect, the monthly benefits are 0.67% of the total assets of the fund. On a monthly basis, and we're 87.5% funded. I think that the policy issue, quickly to wrap it up, is what do you do when the legislation was initially enacted? You defined excess investment income as 1%, 0.5% went to members, 0.5% in essence was a credit against state funds. The state's no longer contributing. Mr. Shermer said, what should happen to that? This is the fund's suggestion on how to deal with it. There's one amendment that has a local approval clause. I think it's consistent when it's a benefit issue that it would be appropriate to add Amendment 1A if you choose to pass the legislation.
I'd move Amendment 1A. Madam Chair.
Representative Thiessen moves the approval of the adoption of Amendment 1A, which gives the local approval. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion is adopted. Ms. Hodges or Ms. Wagner or
good morning, Madam Chair. Thank you again for allowing me to testify this morning. I'm Betsy Hodges. I'm still chair of the Intergovernmental Relations Committee with the City of Minneapolis. I am joined this morning by my colleagues, Councilmember Colvin Roy and our Ways and Means Chair, Paul Ostro. And I am here to testify against the bill as it is written. As you know, and as was just discussed, the MFRA recently provided a determination notice highlighting that all members of the fund will again receive a post-retirement benefit, commonly known as the 13th check, which I won't say again, distributed from $2.6 million in excess investment income. This will be the sixth distribution of these post-retirement benefits to members in the last 10 years, and they have ranged from $1,800 to over $10,000. And on June 1st this year, the bonus distribution to retirees with 42 units will be, as Mr. Rice stated, $2,586, I believe. And while the MFRA may argue that this bill does not impact the city financially, I would like to speak to some of the broader public policy impacts. And first, I'd like to say that the city is, of course, completely committed to meeting our pension obligations. And while I agree with Representative Kahn that it is less than an ideal practice, and even though it is one of our better funded plans, the city has still had to bond for $4.7 million for MFRA in 2004, and our taxpayers have paid over $10 million in excess of payroll costs since 2000. As these large payments show, we are, of course, committed to meeting our obligations to our retirees. But I'm here today to argue that we need to balance that obligation to our retirees with our obligation to the taxpayers. So second, and more to the point, MFRA is currently only funded at 87.5%. Yet even as these supplemental checks are being issued to members, the city is paying over $3 million to MFRA-related obligations in 2007. So House File 2453 will increase all future bonus checks for a select group of retirees. We are not asking you to take away benefits that retirees were counting on. I am not asking you to take away benefits that people were counting on at all. But these dollars are not dollars retirees were counting on for their retirement. The city maintains its position that it is not good financial or public policy to increase benefits to funds that are not fully funded. If the state is no longer going to be receiving those payments, we respectfully request that these funds instead be returned to the employer to be positively reinvested back into the fund. At a minimum, the payment should remain in the fund to accelerate the return to full funding. And finally, in the event of a future market downturn, the taxpayers in the city will bear the full responsibility for any liabilities. Our taxpayers are taking the risk on these funds, and we are glad, of course, to meet those obligations. But we will be taking full responsibility for any liabilities that occur in the future. We are the ones, our taxpayers are the ones taking the risks. I would like them to see some of the benefits in the form of positive reinvestment back into the fund. I would simply request that this money help offset some of those costs in the future. So you've heard from us in the past that there's a disconnect between the governance and the financial responsibility for the plan. And as some of you may know, we are currently in litigation with this fund over improper payment of benefits. This legislation would exacerbate a governance problem between those taking the risk and those held accountable for any negative results of those risks. So I instead today ask that you not compound a government and a liability problem and instead return those funds to the employer for investment back into the fund.
Representative Kahn.
Madam Chairman, the first thing is, since there is a local approval clause, it doesn't seem to matter to us whether the city has total, you know, the total control over it. So this testimony seems particularly irrelevant. But the next thing is, I do believe that we have heard that a fund, an open fund that's over 85% funded is the equivalent of fully funded. Because that's a very, and second of all, the final column comment that was totally irrelevant is if the fund turns down, then you don't give this benefit, because this benefit was only based on performance. And we actually did hear some of the things on funding of plans, I think maybe dealing with St. Paul teachers, that the idea of a temporary benefit that's only performance-based is not deleterious to the fund. But I thought that this, you know, particularly since there is a local approval clause, and I guess we unanimously accepted that, I think that's enough input for the city.
Representative Thiessen.
Well, Madam Chair, this is a first of all, we have to change the law because it doesn't apply anymore. So we have to make a change to the law because this language that's being deleted is irrelevant under the current circumstances. And the thing that...
Because the state's no longer putting money in.
Exactly. And so really the question is, where does that extra half percent, where should that extra half percent go? And it's not really a half a percent because it's capped, as was explained by the rule. So what it came down to for me as I thought through this, first of all, although the argument is probably true that the pensioners were not expecting this benefit necessarily. The city also was not, and they have not budgeted for it. And because they were of anybody, they were never going to be the recipients of this half a percent. Now, whether it should stay, and then the other thing, if you read the language, you know, it does say 0.5%. And on line 2.10, I'm looking at now 0.5%. That was because of this division. I think the more relevant legislative intent going back is that next section, which talks about setting a cap on what the retirement benefit would be to 1 month, basically the 13th shekel, although no one likes that word, but 1 month of benefits. And I think we're just kind of returning with this amendment to the original intent, which is a capped amount, just eliminating the piece that because the state was putting money in and getting money back out to cap that. So this piece, and we've talked, I talked yesterday with the city that came to see me about this, and I've thought about it since, and I think based on what we were trying to do in the past, as I can kind of figure it, I obviously wasn't here, but figure it out from the language, this seems to be consistent with where the legislature, what the legislature was thinking about in the past.
Madam Chair. I've got a procedural question. The Senate has a floor session that starts at 10. Is that when the House is going in as well, too?
That's when we're going in as well, too.
What do you think we should be doing?
I think we should continue with the agenda until we finish. And I expect that will be about 9:45.
Okay.
Thank you. I hope. Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We heard some testimony on is this fund sufficiently funded, well funded, it's as good as fully funded. In 1999, the funding ratio was 109% with a surplus. And so if you look in your in the materials that were provided to us, attachment B, I think gives a pretty good illustration of and helps to put in perspective the nature of this discussion. And while there was an argument made that there's money there to offer this extra benefit, if you will, I hope that the commission will consider what some good public policy might be and look at the volatility of the funding ratio over time.
Well, Representative Kahn.
The point that I made is that this kind of benefit respects the volatility of the stock market. And if you notice that this benefit was put in 1989 when it was 57.3% funded, and it, you know, still went up to 109, I guess, in 99. So this kind of benefit does respect that volatility, as opposed to the kind of benefit that permanently goes into place.
Madam Chair.
Senator Wergen.
Madam Chair, the whole bill, unless it has the 1A, the local approval clause, I don't think should be done.
Yeah.
It does
with the local improvement clause, I'm okay. Yeah. But it does go to what Senator Lynch is saying, is that the greater discussion that this pension commission has to have is whether or not it's appropriate for any fund to be paying out a bonus check, a 13th check, an extra month, I don't care what you want to call it, when the fund isn't 100% funded. I understand this one because of the dynamics of the plan and the state contribution, but there is a greater discussion that we need to have as to the appropriateness of any extra funds being paid out on any kind of a retirement fund that's not 100% funded.
Representative Thiessen.
We don't need to go. She's right. But I think this is the kind of, I mean, everybody that's talking about that is suggesting that this type of retirement bonus piece that doesn't go into the base is probably the direction we ought to have been going with all of our other funds a long time ago.
And that came out in earlier discussions, I think, at the second meeting. Senator Larson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think there are two key points. I think Representative Thiessen makes a key point. But this isn't a rolling into a future benefit. This is a determination based on performance. And, you know, performance isn't good. It's not even a consideration. But I think the key to the rest of the discussion is the local approval clause. And I've heard the city's concerns, and I think this just allows the discussion to move forward. But clearly that, I think, allows us to pass the bill here today with my comfort.
And if we do nothing today, then there's going to be nothing that they have with between the city and the firefighters to continue discussions. And there would probably be, in my opinion, continued animosity, and that's got to stop pretty soon. We've got to make for... and a table where there can be more beneficial discussions to both parties. Representative Thiessen?
I'll renew my motion.
Representative Thiessen moves adoption of 2453 as amended. All in favor?
Well, Madam Chair, let me just make a comment.
Betzel?
I'll support this only because it has a local approval clause. But I just know what's going to happen is that somebody else is going to come in and make the argument that as long as, you know, you have some performance and there's some extra money here, we should do it there. And I hope nobody comes before this commission while I'm on here and makes that argument, because I'm not going to be very receptive to it. Not at all.
Madam Chair.
Representative Thiessen.
And Madam Chair, to that point, I don't disagree. I think this is a circumstance, not only because of local approval clause, but also because the law doesn't make any sense anymore, that we ought to be making this change. And I think that distinguishes it from all those other requests as well.
Okay. Senator Olson.
And Madam Chair, again, I guess I would echo what everyone else has said about, because of the local approval clause, However, we are making a decision about the direction we're allowing them to go, and I would echo the concern when the fund is not fully funded. And I know that I've had a lot of employees talk to me about what we can do to protect their funds and make sure that they stay fully funded. And even though this may be a different type of fund, it is, in my opinion, sort of sending the wrong message.
Well, Representative Kahn.
I can just kind of make a mathematical analogy. When you have an open fund, as long as the two curves aren't diverging, as long as the benefits curve is not diverging from the payback, there is no problem. It just means that it pays off slower than it would before. As long as, if you could just think of doing it, you have a reaching fully funded, and as long as the curve, and we're watching the curves, and this one, since it doesn't do anything permanent, it doesn't interfere with that. As long as the lines are approaching that asymptotically, it doesn't matter if they're doing it slower. I know that's a big word to use for a lawyer, but it really is a meaningful word.
Careful. All in favor of the Thiessen motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion is adopted. Thank you. Mr. Olin, you have four widows in Thief River Falls that need an amendment.
Yes, that's exactly what I've got. Basically, what happened here is the city clerk contacted Larry Martin before she told me. I knew about this yesterday morning, so I'm not coming in because I'm late. City clerk should have came to me first, but that's beside the point. What I'm doing is, in 1985, the city of Thief River Falls got a pension annuity set up for some, or pension fund set up from survivors, and they maxed it out at 600. Well, at this stage this year, we're now past 600, and what they need is a quick fix for 1 year and or 2 years, and I'll get a better bill made in the meantime so we can get an actuarial as long-term effect, allowing them to increase the pension benefits by the 3.5% that was allowed in the statute. So it would be going beyond the 600 with a max out of 640, which I think it only goes to something like 613. Mr. Martin was kind enough to make this a 4A amendment on my behalf. So,
Representative Nelson moves adoption of Amendment 4A. Any further discussion? We've done this before, Representative Olin. All in favor of Amendment 4A, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
We have helped four widows in Thief River Falls, and Thief River Falls is going to come back with proper language based on actuarial projections.
And
thank you. And that will be incorporated in the omnibus bill. Representative Thiessen, St. Paul Teachers, do you have any language for us?
Madam Chair, I think that the two pieces that I'm particularly interested in would be the extending out of the amortization date to 2038, which I think would be consistent with at least our statewide teachers' plan, and moving forward on the shift in the post-retirement adjustment mechanism. So that's sections 5, 6, and 7 of the bill.
Any discussion?
Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
Representative Thiessen, you're talking about adopting the 7A amendment. Are there other amendments that you're referring to? I'm trying to figure out what we're doing here.
Mr. Kepler.
Madam Chair, members, to affect the cost of living adjustment piece of the bill only as Representative Thiessen is is discussing with you at this point in time would, I think, require deleting sections 1 through 4. 7A would be, I think, a necessary amendment to affect what the senator wants to do with the bill. I think staff and myself and Mr. Rice have also discussed other technical fixes that are needed to the bill covered under amendments 1A, 2A, 7A, and then 18A. And I think those would succeed in accomplishing what the two policy pieces of the bill are, the amortization target date extension and the conversion to the Social Security system-based cost of living adjustment. In addition, at the last hearing, as you may recall, we discussed, and I think Mr. Martin drafted an amendment to fix the proration language on the new cost of living adjustment mechanism, which we could review again if you'd like, but I think he's already got that language. And another item that you may or may not want to consider at this juncture is the authority to amend the bylaws, a provision to do that, because we do have the current post-retirement adjustment mechanism is restated in our bylaws and references 354A. If we were going to modify it, I think we'd probably be most efficient just to reference a new statute.
Mr. Martin, was that correct? 1A, 2A, 7A, and 18A?
Members, yes. Well, Representative Thiessen only wants a portion of his bill.
Right.
And I don't have an amendment that deletes all of the sections that you want to delete. And for instance, 1A is drawn to a section that you want to delete. So,
I think the first amendment, Madam Chair, would be delete sections 1 through 4. Okay. Partly because I don't think we have the money to do that.
I think you're right.
Representative Thiessen, I think I also would recommend if you go to Section 8, you have a repeal of Section 127A.50, Subdivision 5, and that is related to your changes to Sections 1 through 4, and you would not need that.
All right, I'd incorporate that as well.
So should we take that as a separate?
I think we can take those all together.
And so delete sections 1 through 4 and 8.
No. I think in 8 it's just deleting the words sections 127A50 subdivision 5.
That's correct. I stand correct. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion is adopted. Representative Thiessen.
And then I believe Senator Betzold was referring to, and now I'm losing it, the 7A, is that correct?
Well, Madam Chair,
Senator
Betzold. Representative Thiessen, you talked about extending the amortization date. I believe that's 7A.
Has something to do with the aid increase in sections 1 through 4.
I think the date is already extended in the bill itself.
Yes. Members, if you turn to page 7, line 3032 would extend the amortization date to 2038.
All in favor say aye.
Aye. We're not. Right. We don't want that, actually. There's no amendment.
You don't want?
No
amendment.
Yeah. We want to leave it.
Okay.
So do we, Madam Chair, do we need anything other than the 18A is a technical amendment.
I don't know if we need anything other.
Members, 18A relates to Section 1, which you have
deleted,
not dropped.
So there's nothing.
Mr. Kapler did recommend on page 5, page 5, line 25, delete rounded and insert calculated and delete nearest. And then on page 5, line 26, delete the whole line and insert three decimal places, period.
That was last meeting.
Yeah. That was discussed or referenced last meeting. I don't believe that you actually acted upon it. So.
I'll move that.
Representative Thiessen moves that deletion and addition on line 525 and 526. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Anything else? So we did it.
No, I need a bill as amended.
And so Representative Thiessen moves adoption of 2341 as amended. Any further discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Okay. Representative Nelson, you will be so kind.
Quickly, this bill comes out of one of our first pension meetings this year, where the widow came forward, and the discussion that came out of that, and the pension plan that I'm most familiar with is the one I'm involved in with the Carpenters Union, and it's covered by ERISA, and you have the default for that is a 50% for life benefit. And you can opt out of that, but you have to proactively opt out of that, as opposed to my understanding of the state pension plans where you have to opt into that. And I guess this, I would just, I mean, going forward, I think this would be better policy if we had that opt out of it. And that would be, they have to do it proactively instead of later on, 20 years down the road or 10 years down the road, a widow come forward and saying, I didn't have the option to opt out of this. No one informed me, and have to put us in the place of being the bad guys and say no. It's the short.
And we will, if you let us hold it over during the interim.
I think that might be a good idea. There's looking at some of the amendments. There are other issues that are raised, but I think we should look at this in the interim and go forward. I think it would be a good idea if we looked at this and did that with our pensions, because that way we have widows or widowers, I mean, spouses out there that at some point having not only have the unfortunate having their spouse pass away, but then the fact that they're left destitute.
Thank you. And, Senator, you agreed that we can talk about this some more in June or July or August.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And so that's for interim study. And then number 7 on the legislative auditor is the legislative auditor still here? Ms. Vanek has communicated with us about some things that we should have in law. And Ms. Vanek, do you have an opinion?
Madam Chair and members, Mary Vanek, Director of PERA. I spoke to Mr. Nobles. He had to leave. And he shares the same position at this time as the fund directors, that if the commission could meet after session and address the accounting change concern that appears in your actuarial standards of work, that the commission has full authority to adopt and doesn't require legislation, and that we could have continued discussion with the commission on a number of other issues that were raised in the bill that we asked you to pull last agenda. It's House File 2361, Senate File 1978, and have the actuaries in to have more discussion that would be a bigger picture that would also apply to this discussion about the post fund and the structure and how it's reported. And so we could address that after session as long as we get it, the standards changed before mid-August when the actuaries start their work for the next reports that you'll receive.
And Ms. Vanek, we can do that. And will you please, if if there's some specific language that the legislative auditor feels that we have to have in the law, if the legislative auditor could get that language to us before Thursday's 8 o'clock meeting in government op, I will consider it.
Okay, Madam Chair, I will let him know
I'll
that.
I'll consider putting it in that bill
yes.
then.
Okay.
But otherwise, it was my intent to ask you to that we could hold discussion on this until a meeting in July or August. Okay. I mean, in June or July, because I know it has to be done before August.
What?
Okay,
Madam Chair, I'll let him know.
All right, thank you. But specific language, if we want law changed, I want to know what the specific language is. I don't want to be able to make up the law, the language as we're sitting here. That takes too much time. Okay.
Chair, if is there any other business?
We do have the omnibus bill is in front of us.
I'll move that the omnibus bill, as amended, be approved by this commission.
Okay. And there's one change to that by MSRS, is that you're asking?
Is that it?
Yeah. There's one amendment that MSRS is asking us to...
I'll withdraw the amendment pending this amendment. I'll withdraw the motion pending this amendment.
Members, you have the 3A documents before you. This is some changes, relates to the correctional plan portion of the bill. These are technical, not substantive changes. This just clarifies procedurally how they're going to do the transfer of
the 3A
past
amendment.
Service credit.
Representative Kahn moves adoption of the 3A amendment. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Amendment is adopted. Mr. Laurel, the 2A amendment that you asked about the identity and number of the available Federal Internal Revenue Code, is that for this bill?
It
doesn't know.
Okay.
Never mind.
Okay.
There are the Betzelt motion to adopt the omnibus pension bill as amended and with the instructions that staff can make technical changes.
Yes.
That apply as they go through it is before.